Labor unions in Wisconsin may be down, but they are not out, according to our guest this hour. Good morning, I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Monday, August 11th. In this first half of our state capital report, we will talk with a guest who predicts that the income gap will prompt a union comeback. And while it may take a while, he says a fresh pro-worker movement is already underway. Do you think unions will see a comeback? Do you hope that is the case or not? And why or why not? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Barry Eidlin, a postdoctorate fellow in sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He was interviewed for a report that was published in the Capital Times last week, and he joins us from Los Angeles, where it's 9 minutes after 5 in the morning. Thanks very much for being with us.
Glad to be here, Joan. I've got my coffee, so I'm ready to go.
Oh, good, I'm glad. I've got mine, too. Now, Wisconsin unions, at least public unions, are certainly down right now after Act 10, the recall elections, and the Supreme Court's recent affirmation of Act 10, saying it is constitutional. Talk some about why you think that this isn't necessarily the end of unions as we know them.
Yeah, that's a very good question. It certainly, I'm not trying to paint a rosy picture here. There's no question that unions are in decline and have been so for the past few decades. I think it's important to start off with some numbers to get a bit of a sense. So so Wisconsin membership rates for unions actually increased last year from a low number of 11.2% to a still low number of 12.3%. That was actually on the high end in a year where national union membership stood pat at about 11.2%. Mm-hmm. So in Wisconsin, we've actually seen an uptick. In the public sector, it did fall somewhat from 37 to 35%. It was offset by an increase in the private sector from about 7 to 8%. So, unions are sort of in a holding pattern at the moment. That's not anything to be cheery about for unions, to be sure. And Act 10 is not doing anything to make that better for unions, not that it's supposed to.
Yeah. What do you think led to the slight increase in private union membership or union membership for non-public employees?
Yeah, it's hard to tell anything specific from the data. Part of it was that there was an aggregate decline in employment overall, and so in the private sector, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, private sector employment fell by about 35,000 jobs last year. Whereas union membership actually increased in that time period. So, just by the laws of fractions, if your denominator decreases and your numerator increases, the number goes up. And that's consistent with oftentimes, unions are good. One thing that unions do is protect job security. So, obviously it can cut both ways. Industries that are in decline, if they are heavily unionized, you can see a strong decline like you have in the auto industry, for example. But it's hard to tell without really digging into some specific case studies.
Well, what makes you think that unions are going to make a comeback, albeit that it'll take a while?
Yes. So here's the thing. While unions have been in decline for a variety of reasons, and in my own research, I've explored those reasons. The fact remains that there are real problems in the economy for a large segment of the population. We are in an economy where, as I said in the interview, and I've talked about in my research, you know, and other people like most recently Thomas Piketty has talked about, you know, we have an economy where a large percentage of the economic gains are going to a small fraction, the top, you know, 1% of the economy, and the rest of us are not seeing gains. And so that's creating a real sense that there's something wrong, that, and we've seen that, you know, I mean, there was the Occupy movement a few years back. But more generally, you know, people are talking more about this idea of inequality, and that those kind of grievances are not going away. There's a greater sense that, that is just not sustainable. And the shape that's going to take, you know, that's going to sort of redress that inequality problem, I can't predict that, and I'm not trying to. But what I am saying is that that kind of grievance just is, something's going to have to happen about that. You know, you can't just have an economy where more and more people are getting left behind.
So are unions going to have to do anything different to return to a position of more prominence?
Well, yes. I think that's going to be essential. I think that one of the key things that's going to have to happen, if you look at, you know, how unions have been successful in the past, it really has to start in the workplace. It has to be a broader vision of unionism that starts as sort of bringing democracy to the workplace. And that's really where unions have been able to build power in the past. And ironically, as unions grew stronger, you know, in the post-war period, that's precisely the thing that they turned away from and turned more towards a strategy of, you know, winning influential friends in Washington and state capitals and so on. And so what we have to see now is a turn back to that. Now, obviously, the economy, the workplace, has changed considerably since the post-war period. And so the actual shape that kind of organizing is going to take is going to look a lot different than it did. But it's still going to be, I mean, people still work, and people still work in workplaces, and that is going to still have to happen, that organizing in the workplace is going to be the building block for whatever is going to happen next.
We are talking with Barry Eidlin, a postdoctorate fellow in sociology at UW-Madison, who says it's going to take a while, but labor unions in Wisconsin will have their day in the sun again. He says that the growing income gap will lead to labor's resurgence, and we welcome your thoughts and questions. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are examining labor unions during this half of our state capitol report with a guest who says that the income gap will likely revive labor unions. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Let's take your calls and questions. John in Appleton is first. Hello, John.
Good morning, Joy. I'm good. Thanks for all you do, and thanks to the guest. I'm supportive of his research, and come from a background of both working in the private sector and in the public sector. But my question is, so I've seen the wage issues at both ends. And my question is, to the extent that he can, does he think Act 10 is actually going to boomerang and cause support for his conclusion here in Wisconsin? You know, I think unions are a good organization, and they are at least more adept these days to weed out the bad than just to protect the bad. So I'd like his comments on both Act 10 as well as the evolution of unions.
Yeah, and I just want to understand what your question is, John, so our listeners understand it too. You're asking if Act 10 will boomerang in what way?
Well, to me, Governor Walker attacked unionized workers by putting in Act 10. And so he demonized the labor unions. And so now with the wage gaps as they exist and are potentially going to get worse, does this cause a resurgence for people to join a union or for people to say, hey, we need a union here because our wages need to keep up?
Mm-hmm. Very.
Yeah. No, that's an excellent question from the caller. So as to whether there's going to be this boomerang effect, you know, I'm not sure. I mean, obviously there was the initial boomerang, which was the Wisconsin uprising, Capitol occupation situation. As to the, you know, I think it could. It's not out of the question. It's certain that the question of sort of state efforts to repress unions historically is complicated, and sometimes it succeeds in terms of actually suppressing unions, but sometimes it does have this boomerang effect. My own research is a historical comparison of what's gone on in the U.S. and Canada, and one of the reasons that Canadian unionization rates are now more than three times high, or almost three times higher as they are in the U.S., is ironically the consequence of more repressive attitudes by government towards unions earlier on that sort of caused unions to fight back more, just as the caller is talking about. So, and those dynamics are, you know, aren't necessarily going away. So we could see a resurgence of that. With regard to the second point about the sort of evolution of unions' roles, this idea that unions sort of protect you know, lazy workers or what have you. You know, I think that the question is really one about due process. And, you know, I think that there's always ways to, you know, find a workforce that works for everybody. And, you know, traditionally what we found is that in systems where there aren't unions, who gets defined as a lazy worker is a very subjective thing and often ends up being subject to a lot of management prerogative. And that's not to say that there aren't lazy workers, but at least with a system in place of union representation, there's a way of fairly determining those kind of questions.
Let's take another call from David in Janesville. Hello, David.
Good morning. I'm a 60-year-old interstate truck driver, and I've been in and out of a lot of industry, okay? I've never belonged to a union in my life. My father was a Teamster. But what I see today, and I think unions, from what I saw when in Madison with these paid protesters that literally wrecked our Capitol building, but anyway, unions have to change their strategy completely. They're still working off the playbook of 1900, 1920, where the boss is the enemy. Let's go throw a rock at his head to get what we want. That's not going to work anymore. What I see in my own sons, and I see in industry, and I've been in and out of Detroit. I've been into a lot of places. You used to have 80 people making an item. All those machines are in the dumpster. You've got three people making that same item. Education. What I see with my sons, all my sons are doing well. They all went to college. They all educated themselves. But it's skilled jobs these days. My brother runs a company in Schofield where he needs machinists. He needs skilled tradesmen. They come in and they negotiate themselves, and they're making good money. But the unions today where, you know, where you take maybe 100 people and pay them so much an hour to do move widgets, that's not going to work anymore. What I see with these young people today is they go in and they negotiate on their own. and they're doing quite well.
All right. Thank you, David. Lots to go here and running short on time. Barry Eidlin, David says workers will negotiate their own salaries, I guess. Unions aren't really needed.
Yeah, no, that's a classic argument against unions. The problem with the caller's analysis is that it's not consistent with the economic data about where jobs have actually grown. Job growth in this economy has been overwhelmingly at the bottom end of the scale. Unskilled jobs, fast food, home care, I don't want to call home care unskilled, the jobs that pay low wages, and unions have traditionally played a role in taking these jobs that are low wage, that have low bargaining power, and making them into better jobs where people can actually make a decent living. You know, the home care ruling, the home care workers in Illinois that were the subject of the Harris v. Quinn Supreme Court ruling recently, before they were unionized, they were making barely minimum wage. Now by the end of this year, they'll be making $13 an hour. It's not great, but it's more, and it's a better wage to get by. They've got health care. They've got training. That's another thing, is that unions also play a role in helping to build workers' skill level. And a lot of unions have training programs that I really would challenge a lot of the caller's presumptions about the role of unions in this economy.
Sandy in Madison is with us. Hello, Sandy.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I think part of what goes on is that you have to have two counter sides sort of balancing out where human beings go. You know, when it's just human nature and certainly a model for capitalism, where if management has an unlimited amount of power, that they're not necessarily going to be thinking of the good of the individual and rationalizing it. I think that Scott Walker played to the lower part of human nature by creating this us-against-them mentality about state employees who, many of us, are doing it because we enjoy being able to do the right thing rather than competing for finances. And I do think that the pendulum will swing back, but I think it's going to take unions to sort of limit that power. Thank you.
Reaction to that, Mary?
No, that's an excellent point. I mean, I think it goes back to the point I was making about unions as sort of a mechanism for bringing democracy into the workplace. I think, you know, we all talk about how great an idea democracy is, and we all talk about the genius of the sort of U.S. Constitution providing checks and balances on different kinds of authority, but then all of a sudden we go into the workplace and somehow the idea that some sort of what essentially amounts to a more or less benevolent dictatorship is the way to go. So I think that, you know, that if checks and balances and democracy work for us as citizens, why can't they work for us as workers?
Does how important is the politician at the helm to the labor movement in Wisconsin, for example? If Governor Walker wins re-election this November, or Mary Burke wins the election in November, isn't the future much different for unions?
You know, in the short term, yes. I mean, obviously, Mary Burke is going to. Is seeking labor's endorsement, so is less likely to have take the more draconian, openly anti-union tack. But the long-term trend, it's not going to really move the needle. I think that we've seen labor's decline under Democratic regimes as well as Republican regimes. And in fact, you know, one of my arguments is that, you know, part of labor's problem has precisely been this overly relying on the Democratic Party to win gains for labor. And I think that in terms of trying to actually reverse the trend, not just the sort of short-term losses, it's going to take developing a degree of political independence from the Democratic Party. And again, you know, what shape that takes is open to debate. There are a lot of people, you know, discussing, that's been a hot topic of debate, for some time, but that in terms of long-term trends is what's going to have to happen.
Yeah. Well, do you think Wisconsin might be a national leader in labor's resurgence?
It certainly could be. It has been in the past, so it's got a habit of doing that with publics leading the way for public sector unions, leading the way with sort of a more politically independent approach earlier on in the, with the progressives. So I would not be at all surprised to see that.
Yeah, 30 seconds to go. How long is this going to take?
I do not want to make any predictions on that. What I will say is that it's very hard to predict when these upsurges happen, and then once they do happen, it's always possible to look back and construct a chain that led to that. We saw that with the civil rights movement. We saw that with the labor movement in the 30s. There's no reason that kind of pattern that we've historically seen is not going to repeat itself in the future.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Joy.
Barry Eidlin, postdoctorate fellow in sociology at UW-Madison. We'll check news and then we'll be back. This is the Ideas Network.